You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Warwicker with Weekend, and I have two guests with me for the rest of the programme who'll give us their personal take on the news and the issues of the day. Shiva Rabaran is an Iranian-born writer and researcher who focuses on issues of freedom and art. And Peter Tatchell is a UK-based human rights and democracy campaigner, and both are here with me in the studio. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
Shiva, a word of introduction to you first. Tell us a little bit about your career path, writer and researcher. How did that all come about?
I was always an avid reader, so that was all I could do. Since, you know, the age of five, I could already read. And when we were walking in Tehran, I would read all the signs. The whole city was just something to be read. And that's how I got interested into writing, because that was sort of the only subject I was good at from the start.
And in terms of moving around, born in Tehran, as you just mentioned, and then you moved to Germany at quite a young age?
13 and a half in 1984, yes.
And that was largely because of events in Iran?
In Iran, yes, yes. I mean, people were already leaving after the revolution happened in 79, but my family actually, we had a lot of sort of revolutionaries, anti-Shah people. But after the war started and the mullahs consolidated their power, they started to kill and torture and rape the old revolutionaries, the people who actually brought them to power. And this is what happened in my family as well. We had a lot of, you know, my mom's cousins, sisters, they were very active. And my youngest aunt was executed at the age of 18 without a trial in 82. Two of my uncles were executed in the 88 killings. You know, there was the Auburn trial just in London, I think, last year. And also they were talking about these killings in the 1980s. So, and that was all without trial. And the family only learned about it a couple of weeks later. Some people were lucky because we could get the bodies. This is what they are doing today. You know, they are snatching the bodies. They are hijacking them, and then they would give it back to you if you promise not to mourn, which is what my family did. But some families were more courageous and they mourned, so they would come and get more people. And this is exactly the same pattern we are seeing. It's actually not as bad as in the 1980s, but we are just afraid that it might become as bad.
Well, we will talk more about current events in Iran, certainly later on in the programme, and about aspects of your other work as well.
Yes.
Peter, I was struck when I was anticipating your arrival this morning by just how long you have been campaigning under the banner of human rights. It goes back decades, doesn't it?
I began way back in 1967, and I've been doing it ever since. Over the years, I've been engaged in over 3,000 different campaigns. I've been arrested nearly 100 times. I've been physically violently assaulted more than 300 times because I've upset a lot of tyrants and torturers. But I'm still here. I'm 70 now and plan to carry on for another 25 years. I think some people may have seen the Netflix documentary Hating Peter Tatchell, which is currently streaming. It gives a summary of some of the campaigns that I've done over the years. And some of them are based here in the UK, but some are based on supporting human rights defenders in other countries, including in Iran and Russia and many other places where tyranny prevails.
I watched that programme, and one thing that struck me about it was that it portrayed you in a pretty positive way. And I wonder what the public reaction to you has been as a result of it being watched as widely as it has been.
Well, of course, you may know that in the 1980s, I was widely demonised.
You were.
I was called public enemy number one and many other bad things. But that's because I was way ahead of my time. You know, I remember in the late 70s, I said that Britain should have a comprehensive anti-discrimination act to guarantee equal treatment and protection against discrimination for every citizen. That was denounced as extremist. I argued that workers should have the right to a national minimum wage to end poverty. That was denounced as extremist. But, for example, both those two policies are now the mainstream consensus across all political parties.
The danger is that you're going to be becoming something of a sort of a national hero late in life. Does this worry you?
Well, I've sometimes been described now as a national treasure.
National treasure. those were the words I was grasping for.
But, you know, I don't want to be a national treasure. National treasures end up in glass boxes in museums. And I intend to carry on for quite a number of years yet.
You heard it here first. Plenty more to come from Shiva Rabaran and Peter Tatchell throughout the programme. We're going to go to Montreal first. The UN Biodiversity Summit, known as COP15, which is taking place in Montreal, isn't getting as much media attention as last month's UN climate talks. But as biodiversity refers to all living things on Earth, some might consider that surprising. Government ministers from around the world have until Monday to reach an agreement, which environmentalists are describing as a last chance for nature. The goal is to agree a plan called 30 by 30. That's a global commitment to fully protect 30% of the world's oceans, forests and other vital ecosystems by the year 2030. Well, these marches at a rally in Montreal representing indigenous groups from around the world called for the concerns of indigenous people to be given the highest priority.
The work here right now is to make sure that agreement it has teeth, has money, and has indigenous peoples at the center of being guardians of biodiversity.
The COP15 is happening here, but let's not forget that if we want to protect biodiversity, we need to protect indigenous people first. Indigenous people are protecting biodiversity.
Well, Helen Briggs is a BBC science and environment correspondent who's in Montreal for the COP15 summit, and she outlined for me the prospects for a final agreement.
The main division all along has really been the question of how you actually finance this, given that the most precious remaining biodiversity tends to be in the global south and poorer countries who lack the funds to actually look after the nature there and monitor things and do the conservation. So who is going to foot the bill and whether you need another fund for this? Lots of division over that. Earlier in the week, some countries walked out of a meeting. So there's hope that that can be resolved along with a number of other issues.
The goal is to agree a plan called 30 by 30. Just break that down for us. What does it mean?
Yes, that's the sort of headline of this deal. So putting protections in place to set aside that land, to keep that for nature, to keep it for biodiversity. There are a number of questions around that in terms of how much you include of, say, oceans. Oceans are seen as not getting quite as much attention as they deserve at this summit. And there are talks from some countries to reduce that to 10%. So still work to do on that figure. And then that would be the amount you protect, more debate on actually what it means to have a protected area. So there's one thing actually saying this land is protected, but actually what is allowed on that land is another question. More than 100 countries have signed up to actually put this into place. So more are joining every day, but we'll have to see whether it actually comes to an agreement on that.
What are the concerns of indigenous groups? Some have marched in Montreal while all this has been going on because they have concerns that they're not being given sufficient priority. What are the concerns there? How are they being addressed?
The concerns really are that some of the most precious places on the planet are looked after by indigenous people. And science shows that where you have local communities, indigenous people looking after the land, and then it tends to be looked after very well. So they're concerned that their rights are taken into account in this process. There are some fears that, again, people could be forced off their own land. So this has been quite a big issue at this summit. So trying to ensure that their rights are taken into account throughout this process.
And more broadly, this COP has had less attention than the COP that recently ended in Egypt. But there is so much at stake here, isn't there?
Yes, I mean, that's a theme that's coming through. This is seen as the nature COP, and we've just had the climate COP. And scientists certainly say that the science is there about the need to protect nature, but it isn't quite getting the same sort of headlines that climate change is getting. And it's seen that politically it's not been seen as the same priority as climate change, but these things are two sides of the same coin, if you like. So in order to protect nature, then you have to fight climate change and vice versa. So all these efforts that are going on to stem climate change you need to give equal attention to nature as well. So that's certainly seen as something that politically isn't getting the same attention. And campaigners have called for world leaders to be there for this summit. Now, they weren't actually invited, but campaigners would have liked them to turn up anyway. So instead of having world leaders here, then the negotiations are being done by ministers. And there's some debate over whether there's enough priority from politicians to actually get the work done.
Helen Briggs, BBC Science and Environment correspondent at that COP15 Biodiversity Summit in Montreal. She, with that point she makes about COP15 compared with COP27, which has just finished in Egypt, and the amount of attention that either one gets. Does that concern you as well?
Definitely. I just think the timing was wrong. You know, they were...
Because it was so soon after.
There's some sort of maybe a green fatigue amongst people, amongst politicians. But it really, really concerns me, and I cannot understand. You see, the problem is that all these issues about human life and about the earth or human rights, they have to be translated into money for the politicians to do something. So I think that what people have to do, the activists have to do, is to tell the companies, to tell the politicians that it's good for you economically if you protect the earth, if you protect human beings, indigenous people.
Peter, you were nodding at that. I was interested as well to hear your thoughts on the indigenous people and the fact that there have been these marches outside, the fact that the conference is at least trying to deal with some of the concerns that they have, but overlooked concerns for a long time.
Absolutely. One of the global struggles that I support and have supported for 40 years is the liberation of West Papua, the western half of New Guinea, which was annexed by Indonesia in 1963 and has been under military occupation ever since. Indonesia has allowed its own companies and Western companies to go in there and rip out natural resources, destroying biodiversity, displacing local indigenous peoples. Now, the liberation movement of West Papua has come up with the idea of becoming the world's first green state. That is, a state that would make preserving biodiversity and sustainable economics a fundamental aspect of that state. And absolutely, it would ensure that the local indigenous people are guardians of those natural resources, the plants and the animals, as they've been doing for tens of thousands of years.
Because they know their surroundings best, is the argument.
Absolutely. And it's very clear that in the areas where they haven't been touched by Indonesia, that preservation of the environment, resources and plants and animals is very, very good. The husbandry, the stewardship is very, very positive. So I think this green state idea of the West Papua Liberation Movement is a really good template for other countries to follow.
Shiva, what about the style of protest that we're seeing in this context at the moment? How effective do you think it's being?
I think that a lot of activists are being demonised at the moment, especially the young people who are saying this is, you know, the one life that we have, that we all have. And we're not talking about, say, the world being destroyed in 100 years. It's within the years of our lives. And I fully support them. It's just that they, you know, they're trying to show the world that we are at war, in a way. And that's why some of their protests are being seen as very extremist. You know, they are disrupting traffic or they're disrupting flights. Or going to museums and things like that. But at the same time, they have my sympathy because they want to show the world that this is so urgent. This is like being at war and we have to do something quickly. You know, things can't just go on.
I will come back to you on that later on in the programme, Peter, rest assured, because I've got plenty to ask you about the tactics of protests, and you no doubt have plenty to respond with. But I want to talk about football for the next few moments because Argentina is getting ready. Buenos Aires, you're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Morica with Weekend. A reminder of our main news. The authorities in the Chinese city of Shanghai are closing all schools from Monday amid an increase in coronavirus infections. Now, if you were listening to this programme at about this time last Sunday, you'll recall a discussion we had about the new criminal code in Indonesia. The code will, if and when adopted, effectively criminalise homosexuality in the country. Such a radical transformation of the legal landscape there will probably not be a surprise to one particular community. We're going to hear now about the Warriors. They are transgender women who've been notable in Indonesian society for centuries, but it wasn't until the late 1960s that they were given full legal status in the regional district of the capital, Jakarta. Well, perhaps the most famous trans woman in Indonesia in recent years has been the singer, actress and TV host Dorce Gamalama, who died earlier this year. She was so influential that Indonesia's president, Joko Widodo, was grateful for her endorsement when he ran for office. Well, we can speak now to Benjamin Hegarty, who's an anthropologist and specialist in transgender studies at Deakin University in Melbourne, Australia. He's just written a book, The Made-Up State, Trans Femininity, Technology and Citizenship in Indonesia, which is a study of the Warriors. Benjamin, welcome. Good morning.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit more about this community and their significance in Indonesia.
Yes, so that's right. Waria are a really notable and widespread Indonesian community, a trans-feminine community and term that really gained force in the late 1960s at exactly the moment that the military general Suharto seized power. And so Waria is a notable term in part because it is a new term, and it's one that is created by combining one Indonesian word for woman, wanita, and one Indonesian word for man, pria, in a single term. So it really uses kind of an idea of modern binary gender, but puts it to work in a really distinctive way.
And how have they adapted to the changing laws and the changing attitudes within the country in recent times?
Yeah, so this is an interesting point. And I think we can see, I guess, the recent passing of the criminal code in just a few weeks ago as really a kind of culmination of a series of transformations that Wadiers have lived with for a very long time. So really, the research for the book took place mostly in 2014 and 15, really before widespread anti-LGBT sentiment swept the nation in 2016. What I witnessed in 2014 was an attack on a Transgender Day of Remembrance celebration by a group of Waria in the city. And this came as a surprise even to them, because until that point, and indeed, during that time and until the present day, Warias were in fact a respected member of Indonesian society, respected by their neighbours and even with close relationships to city officials. So this came as something as a surprise. And so I think that marked a moment when Waria really had to, I guess, negotiate and consider the strategies that they had used over the past decades in order to obtain such a visible place. In a sense, that visibility became a kind of boomerang, in a sense, that caused them to be the target of attacks.
I want to bring my guests in with maybe a question or a comment, and then by all means, Benjamin, come back. Peter, what's on your mind as you listen to this?
I'm just wondering where you think this is going to end up, because traditionally Indonesia was a relatively liberal Muslim country, where LGBT plus people were sort of at least tolerated, if not entirely accepted. And as we've seen in many countries, when Islam gets political and gets repressive, LGBT plus people are often the first casualties. And I think of, you know, the many countries around the world where LGBT plus people live in fear of their lives. Do you think it's going to go down that road?
Benjamin, a thought on that before I bring Shiva in.
Certainly. I mean, I think what Waria suggests, if anything, is that regardless of the legal situation, that LGBT people and I guess, you know, various kinds of trans expressions, so Waria, have never entirely been accepted. So really, regardless of the laws, Wadiyas have been living really under the shadow of the possibility of these kinds of attacks and forms of backlash over the past five decades or so. So I think Wadiyas really offer, in a sense, both cause for concern, but also, you know, cause for celebration. I think a lot of strategies, particularly how they've negotiated with city-level officials. And city-level officials have been important in Indonesia because they're the ones who have regulated Wadiyas' presence in public space, not the national level. So I think Wadiyas offer a lot of really interesting strategies with how we might address this changing landscape.
Shiva.
I just wanted to also say something to what Peter said. I just think that whenever religions just become extremist, this is what happens to transgender people. Americans aren't, you know, they aren't Muslim, they are Christians. And now in the Supreme Court, they are threatening the rights of the LGBTQ community. So we do have a problem with religions becoming political, and we need a sort of an empire of human rights everywhere so we can fight against it. And another question is that, for example, in Iran, where I come from, a lot of homosexual men are forced to become transgender because a person's gender is determined by penetration. So if a man wants to live a homosexual life with a partner, one of them has to go through an operation and become a woman, so that sort of, you know, he is forced into becoming a woman so that she can have civil rights. And how is the situation in Indonesia? Can these transgender women, the warriors, marry and have civil rights? Or
Benjamin, we've got about a minute left, so by all means deal with that question from Shiva, if you would.
Certainly. So Wadiya really have managed to, I guess, avoid this degree of regulation in Indonesia. In the 1970s, the Indonesian state did begin to look at surgery and what was called gender reassignment surgery as one particular strategy with which to address Wadiya. But the state abandoned that, fairly quickly. In a way, there's parallels with Iran, but the state did abandon that kind of strategy. So I think in the Indonesian context, there's less of an emphasis on perhaps, you know, genital transformation and a degree of freedom or leeway there.
We must leave it there because time is beating us and the news is imminent. But thank you very much for coming on, Benjamin Hegarty, in Melbourne, Australia. You're listening to Weekend from the BBC World Service. Simeon Tagle, journalist based in Lima on the current political turmoil in Peru. Let's have a further word with Shiva Rabaran and Peter Tatchell, my guests today. Shiva, at the start of the programme, we talked about the fact that you were born in Tehran and moved to Germany when you were in your teens. Now, of course, home is the UK. So you're well placed to sort of compare Germany and the UK and the attitudes to either country from either side. What do you conclude, having lived in both?
Well, The British are still making war films, and the Germans are great Anglophiles, and that's why their heart broke when Brexit happened. They couldn't see the rationale behind it. They thought the British are very, you know, they're pragmatic, they have common sense. But just as lately as 4 weeks ago, the Spiegel had an article called "The Common Nonsense," titled, and with the picture of four prime ministers. Within 3 years, and they were talking about Italian politics. So the Germans don't understand the British anymore. They don't know what happened. But the British, they are still making their war films.
Yeah. Yes. What does that say to you about the state of both nations in 2022?
I mean, from my point of view, I have always, living in both countries, I have always felt very well living in Britain because I think you have a different attitude towards society. You have communities, there are small communities, and an individual can move to and fro. And I like it a lot. It gives you a lot of liberty. Whereas in Germany, they have this idea of integration, assimilation, the big society moving forward, and it can make it very difficult for a foreigner. I think you can live your otherness in a better way in Britain than you can in Germany, whereas the Germans are changing too, because, as I said, they're Anglophile and they look towards the UK ways.
I just wanted to play this little bit of sound to you as well, because there is much debate in Britain at the moment about the pay of certain public sector workers. There are quite a lot of strikes going on in various key areas, including in the National Health Service. This is a clip of striking nurses shouting for fair pay outside. This is St Thomas's Hospital in London on Thursday.
What do we want?
Fair pay!
When do we want it?
Now!
Now, for nurses to go on strike is quite something in this country. The Royal College of Nursing have not done it on this scale in their 100-plus year history. I wonder what that says to you about the state of the nation just now.
I think it's very, very sad. I think you can't be Great Britain and think you are a great nation when your nurses have to go to food banks. And I cannot understand why the government can't do anything about it. You know, they promise they're going to make Britain great again. So the first thing you do is you have to take care of the people who are carrying the society. They're carrying the nation. They didn't break their social contract. Mm. They did everything and now they are not being. And I wish there is much, much more solidarity with them amongst the people of Britain. I hope that they don't get too angry at the nurses because their lives are being disrupted. But you know,
of course, as you know, the government will say we take independent advice from an independent committee that tells us how much we should offer, in this case, the nurses, and we're following that.
Well, yes. There are many independent bodies.
You're clearly
bodies.
Not convinced.
Yes.
Peter, I wanted to talk to you about Qatar. Shiva, I'm going to talk to you about Iran in more detail, current events in Iran in a moment. But I know you wanted to pick out, because you wrote a book, Iranian Cinema Uncensored, published, I think it was 6 years ago now. Two contrasting leading Iranian film directors are very much in your mind at the moment. Why have you picked these two out?
Well, I picked Panahi and Farhadi because for Panahi, film is a political undertaking. And he is extremely popular in Iran. He says that you cannot make art, especially in Iran, without being political. You shouldn't be politicized, he made sure that I understand in his interview with me. But you must be political. And he has used his platform always to draw attention to the plight of the people, to the dictatorship in Iran. And that's what he paid for in 2010. After the Green Movement, he was imprisoned. He was detained first. Then he was under house arrest and banned from work for 20 years. But it doesn't deter him. He has made his best films at home and smuggled out of the country because of his connections to the festivals. Whereas Farhadi never did that. He never used his platform. Lately, he harvested a lot of criticism because at Cannes, when the Iranian actress Zahar Ebrahimi was given the Palme d'Or for her performance, he was one of the jury. She, in her speech, spoke about the woes of the people in Abadan, the city at the Persian Gulf, and how the regime has sent bullets instead of aid to the people when this tower came down and people had nothing. You know, they were looking for their loved ones. And Farhadi did nothing. He didn't say a word. He just smugly, you know, he was a member of the jury. He just sort of stood and just clapped. And and in 2019, where we had the awful November, it's called the Bloody Auban, the Bloody November in 2019, he was, during his press conference about his film, The Hero, he was asked about it and he said nothing. I mean, he didn't even mention it. And that's when the regime killed 1,500 people undercover. You know, there was no broadcasting. They turned off the internet, the satellite, and there was, and that's why they call him Vasat Baz in Persian, which means somebody who's always sort of in the middle. He doesn't want to burn his fingers. He's always on the right side. He wants to get the funding, and so
Well, as you say, two contrasting stories, I should say, in his interest. Mm-hmm. He's not here to respond to that, but you make a very clear point about what you've said in your book about those two and others, indeed. Mm-hmm. We're going to stay in Iran.
Yes.
Because on Thursday, here on the World Service, we heard rare testimony from a doctor inside the country who's been treating the victims of the violent crackdown on anti-government protests. Now, those protests are in their third month. They show no sign of abating, and the government's response has become ever more brutal. In the past, it's executed two demonstrators, adding to the more than 400 people estimated to have been killed since September, either on the streets from live fire, from government forces, or in custody. Now, there are no figures for the number who've been injured, but those who have been rely on a sympathetic network of medical personnel, such as this orthopaedic doctor in Iran. He remains unidentified for his own safety, and his testimony has been voiced by a BBC journalist. First, here he describes the injuries that he's had to treat in the wake of the protests.
Over about past 2 months, I've been treating around 25 or 30 patients who have been injured during the protests. My patients were beaten with batons. Some of them, they had bruises because of shocker. Some of them had their bones fractured, and I've treated multiple of them. There were also a number of patients injured with pellet gun or birdshot. They've been shot at their hands, at their legs, even their faces, and even their fingers. Most of them were very young. Some of them, they were teenagers, but there were also some up to 45 years old or so.
And this was his message to Iranians still protesting to overthrow the government.
I would love to tell them that we can together get rid of this corrupt and tyrant regime. We can free this great country and dignified people from their tyranny and get to the freedom that we want. We shouldn't get tired. We are the many, they are the few. They are terrified. They are divided. All this violence and executions is a sign of their fear and their incapability. Resistance of the people and the continuation of protests will lead to the government to accept that they should leave and to return this country to its rightful owners.
Well, listening to that, and with us in the studio is Christopher de Balaigue, a journalist and author who's covered the Middle East for almost 20 years. He was a correspondent in Iran for The Economist, and his latest book is entitled The Lion House and is about the 16th century Ottoman Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent. Christopher, welcome. Good morning.
Thank you.
The piece that you wrote, it was a long piece in the Guardian newspaper. The headline was Iran's Moment of Truth. What will it take for the people to topple the regime? How do you see this moment of truth playing out in the coming weeks?
The moment is identifiable because, as you said in your introduction, we've been here now for 3 months, and that is completely unprecedented. In the past, since 2005, really, there have been intermittent protests, and they've all been easily snuffed out without really the regime having to break sweat. And this is the first time that the authorities have really had to deal with a protest that not only shows longevity, but also breadth of appeal. Because in the past, we've always kind of felt that the protest movements were serving a particular constituency, a particular social class, a particular set of grievances that not everyone shared and not everyone was prepared to go onto the streets in order to support. This time there's something very different. And what we see is that not only different ethnic groups are united behind this idea of overthrowing the Islamic Republic, but also a broad swathe of predominantly young people, galvanized initially by social radicalism by women, but now much more broadly representative of this bubbling discontent. And the moment is, well, I think your doctor said it very, very well, it's tiredness. Who is going to tire first? And how does that kind of play out in terms of the way that the regime is reacting and the way that protesters react to the way that the regime reacts? This isn't simply about emotion and passion. It's also about strategy. It's also about thinking how these things work and how long it takes. We're going to be coming back in 6 months' time and saying, how are the protests going? Because I think this is going to play out over a long period of time, and it's now a question of attrition. Nothing's going to happen tomorrow or next week. It's a question of attrition.
I'll happily bring my guest in, obviously, Shiva, in a moment. But I did want to feature a couple of pieces of music, because your piece contrasted two very different pieces of music that have encapsulated the protests since the death of Mahsa Amini back in September after she was arrested by the morality police in Tehran. We can hear a little clip of both. The first is from Shervin Hajipour. برای توی کوچه رخ سیدن برای ترسیدن به وقت بوسیدن برای خواهرم خواهرت خواهرامون برای تغییر مغزها که And the second is by the popular rapper Toomaj Salehi shortly before he was arrested at the end of October. از کف میایم به رأس هرم میزنیم شو میکنیم ببین چقدر دیدنی 44 سالتون سال شکست فجیع اون روز همه داره سهم میپرد از کف میایم به رأس هرم میزنیم شو میکنیم ببین چقدر دیدنی 44 سالتون سال شکست فجیع اون روز همه داره سهم میپرد The significance of those in this story?
Well, I think that the first one is a sort of beautiful lament for an Iran that doesn't exist, an Iran that might come into being. And it's an extremely emotional song and a very longing and wistful one. The second one is anger, yeah. And I think that there's been a sense that the first has dominated at the beginning, and we're now in the stage of anger. And Toomaj Salehi is in jail. He's been charged with capital crimes, potentially capital crimes. His song is remarkably kind of galvanizing. It's incredibly direct. It's, you know, these words 5 years ago, 10 years ago, you could not imagine anyone putting words like that out there. And this is another wall that has collapsed, the wall of deference and the wall of fear.
Shiva, pick up on this notion that we're in such different territory today than territory when we have seen protests in Iran in recent years?
The wall of fear has broken down. And I also want to say something to Christopher that you said that the ballad is about an Iran that doesn't exist. It's an Iran that exists, but it's occupied. And it's very important that we realize Iran is an occupied country and the regime is an occupier in collusion with the Russian occupiers of Ukraine, with Putin. And they are all connected. If we, the people of the world, the West, the democracies, get pushed back the Nazi regime of Putin, they will also help Iranians, the occupied Iran, free itself from this regime. And it's very clear that, as you were saying rightly, there is a huge feeling of being united. Mm. Everybody is in this together, except for the regime. And the people of Iran, they are now using the mythical and patriotic verses of Shahnameh, of Ferdowsi's Book of King, to express that. They see, they call Khamenei Zahak, the snake shoulder. They had to Shahnameh is the epic work of Ferdowsi that was written 1,000 years ago, and it's still a blueprint for Iranians. This is what Iran is. And the story is that he has got these snakes and they would eat out his brain if he doesn't bring two young people in to be executed every day. And the executioner takes pity always on one of them, mixes the brain of the executed one with a sheep's brain, and rescues one of the young people. And after 20 years, these young people, who are actually in the poem, they go to Kurdistan and they come down from Kurdistan, which is not very pivotal in this movement. They come down and they free Iran. And the Iranians are now using those images of the Iranian heroes and villains from the Shahnameh.
But you both know how much more the regime could clamp down on this than they have so far. And that yes. must be your fear.
I mean, this is not really as bad in convert commas as it was in the 80s, where I said in the beginning, where my aunt was sure. executed without trial along with maybe 10, 12,000 people. But they could. The only thing is, I think they, my feeling and my hope is that they will tire first. They will become tired. The fatigue will befall them first, before it befalls the Iranian people.
Let me bring Peter in, then I'll come back to Christopher. Mm-hmm. Thoughts, Peter?
I am absolutely heartbroken and very angry that Western governments are not showing the same resolve against the Iranian dictatorship as they are against Russia's dictatorship and invasion of Ukraine.
Exactly.
Any moral person would say that the Iranian ambassador should be expelled from the country, the embassy should be closed down, international arrest warrants should be issued against all those Iranian officials who are implicated in crimes against humanity, such as torture and murder, and a comprehensive regime of personal individual sanctions against the top 10,000 Iranian officials to institute travel bans, asset freezes, and so on, to really punish them and to show that the world is on the side of the people against the dictatorship.
Can you see that happening, Christopher?
I can't see it happening now. I don't think the world, and I don't think the media, and I don't think that the political classes have the bandwidth to deal with really more than one crisis at a time. And so Iran has been relegated to the sidelines, and I think that's felt by people inside the country. I think they derive a great deal of succour and strength from the idea that their cause is being publicised and their cause is being talked about, and it's taken very seriously outside the country. But sometimes I feel that the Iranian people are very much on their own on this.
And they feel like that too.
I think there's a sense that there isn't the same level of support and the same level of interest that was expressed at the beginning of the protests. And there's something about very telegenic images of women taking back their rights that were very, very prominent at the beginning of the protest that the Western media latched onto. And now it's a kind of more complicated picture with lots of different ethnic groups, and now it's predominantly men who are out on the streets, and it's just less kind of exciting for a rather superficial Western media.
Briefly, Peter, if you would.
The four proposals I suggested are easy. They're not difficult. They don't cost anything. They can be implemented within the next week. I think it's a huge moral abdication by Western countries and indeed world governments that they're not doing more to support what is a heroic, an absolutely heroic struggle for democracy and human rights in Iran.
I sense, Shiva, agreement from you on
yes,
that.
Yes, I think that it's, as diaspora Iranians, I think it's very important that we join forces with, you know, activists like yourself, scholars like yourself, that we show the world the fight against the fascist Russian state and the fascist mullah regime in Iran. They are intertwined, that they are connected, and we should implement the policies that Peter was talking about. It's extremely important that we see the connection. And it should have been seen already in Syria when they joined forces and occupied Syria and killed the people.
We could talk at greater length, but sadly we're not able to. Christopher, thank you so much for coming in and outlining what you have written and the situation as you see it in Iran. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Warwicker with Weekend. That was Kim Belware, who's a reporter for the Washington Post, on that report from the Death Penalty Information Centre. Peter, is this an area that you've campaigned on over the years?
In fact, it was one of my first campaigns back in my hometown of Melbourne, Australia, in 1967. A man who was alleged to have shot dead a prison warder during a jail escape was due to be hanged despite conflicting evidence. So I was involved in the campaign to try and stop his execution. Unfortunately, we did not succeed. He was hanged, but he was the last person to be hanged in Australia because of the huge public anger that he was hanged despite doubts about his guilt. I think the death penalty across the board, whatever country, whether it be the United States, Iran, Saudi Arabia, China, the death penalty is a violation of human rights, the right to life. And against cruel, degrading, and inhuman treatments is enshrined in international law. And of course, people who commit crimes should face punishment, but not the death penalty, particularly because there have been so many instances where people have been wrongly executed. Years later, it's often been revealed that they were executed based on false testimony or flawed forensic evidence. So I think the abolition of the death penalty worldwide is a human rights concern.
Shiva, it's interesting, isn't it? Against that backdrop, and those arguments are very familiar arguments in this context, yet still in a country like the United States, where people are entirely free to choose whether they support this policy or not, still 50% do.
Yes, I mean, I think it is religion for me. These are in very religious states where they have the politicized Christianity, where they support the death penalty. It's the same in Iran. We always had the death penalty also under the Shah and before that. But after that, the death penalty, they just kill people. You know, they execute people like, as we say in Persian, like drinking water as easily as that. And I think that the lack of, I think you have to enlighten people. You have to say it's against human dignity. And you and where you have cult-like leaders, where you have very, very politicized, very extreme forms of religiosity, that's where, unfortunately, human rights suffer and where you have executions.
I mean, as you both hint, I mean, this is not about going soft. It's not about avoiding punishing people.
No.
It's about how you most effectively...
Yes.
Punish people.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Because the deterrent issue here is clearly highly questionable.
Well, exactly. These US states still have the death penalty, but clearly it doesn't stop horrendous crimes. And what it does do is bring into disrepute the state, because what the state is doing is sanctioning murder. States that oppose murder are using murder as a weapon. And that's completely contradictory and hypocritical, and it just doesn't work.
And clearly in Iran it is happening as we speak.
Yes.
In the
yes.
context of what we were talking
yes,
about.
Yes, yes. And they just happen, like last week, they executed somebody because he had blocked the street. And they just said, you know, you are an enemy of the state of God. And they just killed him.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Warwicker with Weekend. Shiva, almost the first words you said on this programme today was, "I love reading." So I'm thinking you've probably read 1984, maybe more than once.
Yes, I have read it and I do love it. I think it's fantastic. And I think it's extremely important. I mean, the Iranians also read it in Iran. Mm. As you always turn to literature, you turn to poets. And, you know, they are like you would turn to a sage to interpret the present and see what the future will bring. And I hope that the future of Iran will not be like the one in 1984.
Peter, you couldn't have been clearer in your view of the current Russian government earlier on in the programme. So for Russians to be reading 1984 so much, what does that say to you?
I think it's an indictment of the current Putin regime that people in Russia see 1984 as having a relevance to their own struggle for democracy and human rights and against the lies put out by the Putin regime. Can I just add that George Orwell was, of course, a left-wing socialist, but he was also a Democrat. And so, unlike many on the left, he was consistent in opposing Western capitalism and imperialism, but also against Soviet style, Stalin-style, barbed wire socialism. And I think that's to his great credit, and it's very relevant today in terms of the people's struggle in Russia. Can I just also add that it's also relevant to us as technology evolves and sophisticated state surveillance becomes prevalent in the West. 1984 is very pertinent. It's a warning sign about how technology could be used as an instrument of tyranny, not just in Russian-style regimes, but even in democracies like ours.
James, as a final thought, just picking up where Peter was, this notion of people finding a way in Russia, if they are quietly indisposed or significantly more than indisposed to the Putin regime, they are finding ways, whether it's books or other sources, to try and get some light amidst the darkness.
Yes, they are. I mean, if we're talking back, you know, to the Ministry of Truth and their slogans such as war is peace, freedom is slavery and ignorance is strength, I mean, they're remarkably resonant with the way that the Russian propaganda has sought to portray the military campaign, the war in Ukraine, which, of course, in the Russian media, you're not even legally allowed to call a war without risking jail.
Which is very telling and perhaps a good note for us to end the conversation. James, thank you so much for coming on. James Rogers, historian of writing on the Soviet Union during the 30s, 40s, former BBC correspondent in Moscow. And Shiva and Peter, that brings our conversation to a close as well. So thank you both very much indeed for being a part of the programme today. Thank you for listening to this edition of Weekend, the programme back at the same time tomorrow. The latest news headlines are next here on the BBC World Service.